So the last speaker is Dr. Kenneth Stein from Boston Scientific, Minneapolis.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Giovanni Liana, the organizers. I'm going to begin by maybe disappointing all of you and telling you that I agree fundamentally with the premise of what Dr. Redberg said, which is that as physicians, as industry, as regulators, we need to embrace doing comparative effective research and doing it well within the device arena. I'm going to very briefly explain why I agree with her, but really focus, I think, on what the critical issues are methodologically with doing comparative effectiveness studies well with devices. It's a truism. We live in a time of unprecedented change within the practice of medicine and within the finances of medicine, the medical device industry. You know, on the one hand, we have in front of us tremendous opportunities of innovation, genomic revolution, a nanotechnology revolution, a revolution in computing power and networked computing. But on the other hand, again, we all in the United States, as well as in Western Europe and most of the developed world, face an unsustainable trajectory of the increase in costs for medical care for patients. And you don't need a degree in economics to know that something that's unsustainable is pretty unlikely to be sustained. And so, you know, how do we preserve the ability to innovate, to continue to improve the care of our patients, while at the same time getting back to a sustainable ecosystem in the economics of healthcare? And I think fundamentally, the answer is that we do need to understand the comparative effectiveness of new technologies with respect to existing technologies. In fact, I'd state that that point is unassailable. If we're comparing drug A versus drug B, or for an individual patient, device C, what that patient wants to know is she the right patient to get that device? When should she get it? For how long? What are the treatment paths? What are the outcomes? And although Dr. Redberg shied away from this, I think fundamentally we need to know if an outcome is better, is it so much better that it's worth any increase in cost for the technology? So having said I agree that we need to do it, the on the other hand is if we're going to do it, we need to do it well, and we need to be aware of specific methodologic changes. Some of these challenges are not particularly specific to devices, but I think they're highlighted with devices. And a number of these are issues that actually have already come up during a lot of the discussions this afternoon. And the first is the issue of the application of comparative research to immature technologies. That is, with devices, right, they are almost always launched in a so-called generation one iteration, before the procedure has been optimized, often before the technology has been optimized, before patient selection is well established, and for cost effectiveness comparisons, before pricing has normalized. But the problem, of course, right, is how long do you need to wait? How do you know when a technology is mature enough to subject it to rigorous comparative effectiveness testing? And a second problem, as my daughters continually remind me, it's a very short step from mature to obsolete. Second issue that relates to that is how long do we need to evaluate devices or drugs in trials? What's the time horizon to look at for benefit? I show here examples, both a hypothetical example for an active implantable device and for many active implantable devices, right? Be aware that the mortality differences or the outcome differences can increase over time. And then show some actual data from some of the randomized trials looking at ICDs for primary and secondary prevention. And what you see is that the benefit that you see from the device is strongly dependent on the time horizon at which you end the trial. So that, just to take an example, made it to trial, right? If you had stopped following patients at 1 year, right, you would have concluded that you needed to treat 133 patients to save one life. At 2 years, that comes down to 17. At 3 years, in this analysis, it comes down to eight. And obviously, you know, how long you continue to follow patients, when you publish the paper, when you finally make your comparative effectiveness assessment, then has a huge effect on whether you conclude that this particular therapy is worth the cost or not. And again, to show this in the actual eight-year follow-up publication from MADE at 2, again, number needed to treat to prevent one premature death. This analysis, 18 at 2 years of follow-up, but with extension to 8 years of follow-up in this cohort, goes down to 6. A third issue, and another issue that has been raised multiple times already this afternoon, is the issue of just what is the appropriate endpoint for efficacy. Do we insist on looking at the hardest possible endpoint, mortality? Do we look at softer endpoints, success, responders, heart attacks averted, episode-free days, for devices whose intent is to improve quality of life? Do we have a robust quality of life measure that can be used in a comparative effectiveness study? Last challenge I want to talk about gets to the issue of subgroups, and I don't want to talk about whether subgroup analysis in a particular clinical trial is hypothesis generating or can be considered valid. But I want to speak more broadly about the issue of individualization, personalization, and medical therapy. These are data from the MADE at CRT trial looking at CRT outcomes in mildly symptomatic patients with heart failure, left ventricular systolic dysfunction, and a wide QRS complex. The trial as a whole had a positive result, as you see, a hazard ratio of 0.66 or a relative risk reduction of 34% with the active therapy, and you can base a comparative effectiveness calculation and a cost-effectiveness calculation on that. But, of course, there are some patients in that trial who did very well with the therapy, and some who do very poorly, and sometimes they're identifiable subgroups. So if you look at the left bundle branch subgroup, the comparative effectiveness is much, much greater. If you look at the subgroup of patients in this trial without left bundle branch group, there was no efficacy whatsoever. And again, the overall cost effectiveness of the therapy is very different in the subgroups. But think of what the future brings. Right, the future brings more individualization of therapies, both in the device arena as well as in the drug arena. And with active implantable devices, offers the possibility of individualization of programming strategies as well as individualization of the device itself. In a world where we each consist of a subgroup of one, what are the appropriate methodologic techniques to do perfect or even appropriate comparative effectiveness and cost effectiveness research, right? When it comes down to it, large-scale clinical trials provide us group means, but none of us as individual patients care about group means. We care about the efficacy of a drug or a device for ourselves. So let me conclude then. Medical innovation in the device industry faces unprecedented economic challenges. Again, it's pretty simple to say that the key to sustaining our ability to innovate is to innovate sustainably. And I think that means that while being aware of these risks, the challenges of doing comparative effectiveness testing well, we still do need to embrace it. And that if we embrace it and if we do it well, then it's our opportunity as industry, as physicians, as regulators, to demonstrate that new technologies, new therapies are more than merely safe and effective. It's the only opportunity we have to show that they're worthwhile. Thank you.
We may have time maybe for two questions, and then the next group will be coming into this room, so we're going to have to vacate. Questions? You audience, you haven't said a lot to us. Did you have a question, Roxanne?
Yeah, I mean, I think first I want to just address Rita's mechanism of angioplasty and the fact that the mesh does not decrease chest pain, to tell you that there's definite evidence that there's decreased objective evidence of ischemia in patients who undergo PCI, and I think that that's something that we know very, very well, especially even with fractional flow reserve in intra-procedural fractional flow reserve where there is a, you know, post-angioplasty, there's definite enhancement of the physiological flow parameters. So hopefully that does dictate. But just to come back to that. But I think it is important that while the papers that you've written in JAMA do point out some of the very, very important issues regarding lack of the scrutiny that on some of the very high-risk devices, I think it's also important to note that the 510K and iteration of devices may have been included in that analysis. And I just want to make sure, because while you call those high-risk devices that are getting approved, I'm not sure that you could equate that to, let's say, a TAVR, where there is, in those types of, like, let's say, percutaneous aortic valve replacement, those really do go through a tremendous rigor. And as do, I think, the HeartMate and these, you know, LVADs. And I think it is when it comes to, let's say, a wire or iteration of devices where that the scrutiny perhaps is a little bit less, just to continue the innovation and have those devices be available to the patients. So short of that, how would you want the FDA or our regulators to be able to divide that, and so that it there is a you know, equipoise, if you will, and that so you could be satisfied and everyone else could feel safe that these devices are actually getting a very good review? It's a tough question, I know.
Thanks, Roxana. So first, I don't want to, it's not me personally. I really look at it from the point of view of patients and public health. I have no skin in this game. And we only looked at pre-market approvals in those studies. So you're correct that a lot of high-risk devices don't go through the pre-market approval process. They go through a 510K process, and that's a whole other session that we could have. But we only looked at pre-market approvals. So those were randomized controlled trials, or, I mean, those weren't. But they were the most rigorous. And I think that, you know, certainly, you're right, there's a range of devices even in those high risk, and some of those were hemostasis devices, some of them were stents, some were implanted defibrillators, and some were LVADs. But I think in general, you know, any implanted device has potential, of course, for serious harm, and so, and that's not actually the FDA definition of high risk device, but it just happens that in cardiology most of them are implanted. And so I think that we could make, you know, set the barrier at different places depending on the device, and certainly, you know, we're never going to get huge studies, but I think, you know, the average device trial now is usually a few hundred, and I think that is probably too small, and that, as Ken pointed out, you know, longer-term endpoints are better for a lot of people. There's no question that, and I understand from an industry point of view, that costs more money, and this is expensive. But on the other, you know, from a patient point of view, for at least the riskiest of those devices, I don't see any substitute for having a good randomized controlled trials, because as we're learning from a non-cardiac example like metal on metal, which didn't go through PMA, I mean, or some of the ICD lead problems, it's very difficult once you have that device in to then go back, and it's very difficult once the device is proved to change clinical practice. And so I think we do need to probably, for selected devices, be more careful about our approval criteria.
If I could just add, in terms of significant risk devices, they all go through the rigorous PMA approval process, and shouldn't have the impression that FDA doesn't consider that randomized clinical trials to be the, you know, at the height of the valid scientific evidence pyramid. In fact, for those significant risk devices that have broad public health impact, such as drug-eluting stents and more recently transcatheter aortic valves, and to the consternation and some criticism from the clinical community, we did require randomized controlled trials to establish the safety and effectiveness of those types of interventions. And I think the same principles can be applied to the use of sham controls as with randomized controlled trials, that they are always preferred when feasible and practical, to assess safety and effectiveness. And so I think there's, you know, really a difference between the approach for the establishment of safety and effectiveness versus how the clinical community interprets data for clinical decision making. And I think it does get back to this idea of one size doesn't fit all, the types of trials that are appropriate for the types of devices and either the totally new devices with, you know, broad public health impact or changes of which may be mild, moderate, or more extensive of approved devices that can be evaluated quite well with various types of approaches, including the non-clinical data, use of historical controls, sometimes performance goals, and optimal performance criteria in non-randomized trials.
I want to add to the issue of the objective performance criteria. There are times that the community out there will not enroll in trials where they think that the comparator is so inferior, and that's exactly what happened with the continuous flow pumps. And we went to the objective performance criteria after many meetings with the clinical community that they would not enroll, they would not randomize, and so we came up with the objective performance criteria. And if now you look at the Intermax registry survival, it is pretty darn close and even better than what we had set. As practice gets better and the operators get better and we're better at delivering the care and things that we have learned, then in fact the survival is far superior.
I think the stated criteria on the FDA guidelines for device trials is that while the FDA prefers randomized clinical trials, they consider evidence from case series, expert opinions, and observational studies, and I think that's why we get the mix.
I just add that a wise clinician whom Ileana knows very well often states, perfect is the enemy of good. And the FDA is faced with this every day, and they have to balance it with every one of these trials. They're either being criticized by industry and others who want to get new therapies out as quickly as possible, or they're being criticized by Rita and her band, who are concerned.
A lot more industry reps than the FDA than me.
So it's a tough job, and I want to recognize the FDA for that.
Yeah, and maybe to add one other thing, right, because, and I think this is what Andy was saying, and I think, right, A, you need to balance the potential risk with a new device also against the potential benefit. And I think the sorts of trials that you need to do, the appropriate control group, the appropriate duration of follow-up are going to vary very dramatically across different high-risk devices, depending on whether it's a small iteration to treat a disease for which there's already a perfectly good therapy versus an iteration or a completely novel device that promises large benefit. I think the other thing that somehow I think we miss here, and now I'm speaking as a doc and not as industry, right, is FDA approval doesn't force any doctor out there to actually use something. And if as industry we can't generate the sorts of data that convince clinicians to use devices, then as industry, we're not going to sell the devices. To the extent that the physician community does buy the data out there, then either the data are adequate to support their needs or they're not using appropriate standards.
I believe we have one very last question from the internet waiting.
It's actually
not from the internet.
Am I allowed to ask
a question? You are.
Only if you press your button.
I'll report it to O'Connor.
I'm still a fellow, but I was struck by the differences in how easy it is to get people on clinical trials depending on the disease process. For example, if someone has end-stage heart failure or severe aortic stenosis, it was very hard to get them enrolled in LVAD or TAVI trials. But if you have a malignancy where the mortality may be even better than end-stage heart failure or aortic stenosis, it was much easier. So is the FDA or regulatory people who make these decisions, do they make different decisions based on the disease process? Or
Well, in a way we do. I'm not involved in the oncology trials at all, but we do look at the literature, and particularly in the clinical trials, what the expected survival is, and very much taken into consideration. That's part of the issue in the LVAD trials. And when you look at the Intermax registry, the mortality of level one is awful. I mean, it's worse than 50% in 6 months mortality. So that is very much taken into consideration. And you're right. Unfortunately, the public doesn't realize that heart failure can be as bad as cancer. And they see the word cancer and everybody thinks so negatively, and yet heart failure, in some instances, has a higher mortality than many cancers. So, yeah, absolutely, your observations are on the money.
There's a really different attitude toward clinical trials in cancer. I work in a cancer network, a bone marrow transplant network under the blood part of NHLBI, and we accrue patients more quickly than expected in those trials. Of course, they're also smaller. I think a part of what the issue is what Ileana said, that you heart disease is so common, maybe you just don't think you're going to die from it, especially don't think you're going to die from it quickly. But in cancer, people just go right into trials, and they know without treatment they're going to die.
Dr. Sanad, this was such a good session that we have gone over, but I formally close this session. I want to thank the audience for their participation.